Good morning. My name is Virginia Melton, and I'm a member of the Queen City Al-Anon Family Group in Charlotte, North Carolina. And I'm glad to be with you this morning. I am not a morning person, and I think the God of my understanding is going to make me learn to like mornings sooner or later, because I invariably end up at 10 o'clock, or every once in a while, there's some real sickos on committees. They have the Al-Anon meeting at 9 a.m., and I believe there's a special corner in hell for them, but that's my opinion. Oh, dear. And Saturday mornings didn't used to start like this for me. I don't know what you did with your Saturday mornings, but I started worrying. And I started wondering, how much money do I have on hand? Because we never ended up on Saturday night where they'd take a check or a credit card. They wanted the cash money, especially the police. And so I had a lot of arranging to do on Saturday mornings. And this arranging prevented my doing what normal, I think, mothers and wives did, like make beds and wash dishes and go to the grocery store and scrub the tub and, you know, play with the children. I was too busy to do things like that. So Saturday mornings that start in a different way now, for all the laughter and all of the fun, it really is something for which I am very grateful that it is so different. And I owe a lot of that to Alcoholics Anonymous and the impact of Alcoholics Anonymous on the lives of the alcoholics in my family. And for that, I'm always grateful. But I'm even more grateful for the fact that Alcoholics Anonymous allowed the Al-Anon family groups to adapt the 12 steps of AA for our program and base our program on that. And I'm not going to give you my program this morning. I'm going to share it with you. And I'm not going to be able to give you a program, nor is anyone else going to be able to. You're going to have to get your own. And the tools are the same for all of us, but we have to avail ourselves to them and design, with the help of the God of our understanding, our own individual personal program. And what we need to attend to in our inventory steps may be different, but the thing that's bothering you the most is the thing that you should attend to, even though it may be number 10 on my list, and it's immaterial. I think I have forgotten to thank the committee for asking me to come and share with you this weekend, and I am grateful for that. I've heard of Mont Eagle ever since I've been in the program, and something's always prevented our being here. This is such a lovely room, such a lovely location, and there is a spirit that is here, and it's in the trees. It's in the wind that's blowing those leaves and moving them around this morning. It's in those clouds that are drifting across the sky, just as it was in the smog and the fog the other night, and as it is in the rays of the sunshine that are coming through these windows behind me. That is not electric light. That is the light of God shining through windows made by God's children for the eyes of God's children to enjoy this morning. So it is a special place where we are. And isn't it strange the path that we have taken to arrive here and how we come together and we love one another and we identify with one another. We talk about what low-down creatures we've been, and everybody says, oh, isn't that great? Oh, wasn't that a good story? Say, I took a gun and tried to kill the SOB. Oh, isn't she beautiful? You know? And I went off and left my wife in the hospital and didn't go back and get her for 3 months. Oh, isn't he a fine man? Oh, it's no wonder if people don't understand this, is it? You know, that's I don't understand them either, but that's another. Oh, man. Oh, I've got to stop rambling now and get down to business. I forget sometimes. I start having such a good time, I forget what I'm here for, you know. Okay. We too share what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. That's 33 1/3% for each one. Gives me. Okay. I was born on the eastern shore of Maryland, a relatively well-to-do family, a home situation in which my father didn't go out to earn a living. There was adequate income. Christmas Day at our house was like Schwartz's Toy Store in New York. There wasn't anything we lacked for. I can remember one year receiving a white Angora cap, and oh, I loved it. But I wasn't allowed to wear it because the only one that, as the youngest of four, that could ride me on a bicycle because I was too young to ride one myself was a servant, and he, the white Angora, would get on his black coat. And so I wasn't allowed to wear my white hat. And that is rather typical of that home. Lots of things, beautiful crystal and china and silver, well-educated, famous people, guests in our home. And everything was very, very nice. And as the day would progress, we lived right on the Chesapeake. Someone would run the boat ashore. Someone would say, hey, the mattress is on fire. And we'd go up and push the mattress out of the upstairs bedroom window. And all of these very, very nice people just got low down and common and dirty and nasty as anybody I ever was to see the rest of my life. And so I developed a reverse snobbery. I didn't know that, but I did. And if you had money and education and social position, I didn't want anything to do with you. Because I perceived you as shallow and vain, I wanted nothing to do with you. I didn't want to be like you. My attitude toward life was very negative. I never saw anyone I thought, you're the kind of person I would like to be like, and how can I? I only saw in you what I didn't like and what I wanted to avoid. We were accustomed to spending 1 month every summer with our maternal grandparents in Pennsylvania. And the summer that I was seven, I went on the annual visit and did not return to Maryland. And I know now that, and this is capitalized, of course, the Depression had hit. And this family lost everything that it had. And I know now what I perceived I don't even know exactly what I did perceive it. But I know now they had no inner resources on which to rely. I've also learned through Al-Anon that it's possible to have money and position and education as long as that isn't the only thing you have. And if you don't have anything on the inside, those things aren't going to get you very far. And with having the right stuff on the inside, it doesn't matter whether you have those things. But I know they had no inner resources on which to rely, and they went to pieces. As I said earlier, I was the youngest of four children. My father had become an invalid, and my mother left. And for a long time, even after I came into the program, I said my mother abandoned me. But I've come to understand it better. That isn't what she did. That's what I felt. That wasn't her intention. But the bottom line is, she didn't come back. And to show you how self-centered I was, I spent a lot of years thinking, what is wrong with me that Mother would leave? And after Buck and I were married and we had three children of our own, that question loomed even larger. I couldn't imagine leaving my children and never coming back. I just couldn't imagine it. So it had to be something about me. And I felt that wasn't so far out of step, because when I was in the eighth grade, I was as tall as I am now. I wasn't as fat, but I was as tall. And everybody in my class could walk under my arm. I changed schools one time. They thought I was the new teacher. And I was socially mature, but I was one of the original dumb Doras. I used to sit in the back of study halls, and the guys would tell dirty jokes, and I'd just sit there, and they'd get to the gag line, you know, and everybody'd say, boy, look at that Virginia. She can keep a straight face. It was no effort. I didn't get the joke, you know. But I was known as cool before cool was known, you know. But that's something to watch out for. People aren't always cool. Sometimes they're dumb. It's like an alcoholic in your family that has been in a blackout, and you think that they are open-minded. They don't remember. They're curious about what happened, and they're going to let you tell them. But anyhow, I lived with these grandparents, and they died within 7 months of one another when I was 11, and I became a ward of the Orphans Court of the state of Pennsylvania. And that allowed me the magnificent income of $1 a day on which to live. And in February, I got $28. In April, I got $30, and all, you know, like that. And I was different. I didn't fit into that community. I didn't have a father and a mother, and I didn't live in a home, and I didn't have supervision. And it was very lonely. And I felt very, very sorry for me. But I also felt guilty, and I didn't know that that's what I felt. I felt responsible for things that weren't right, and that means guilt. Now, I didn't know it was guilt, but I felt responsible. And I had been exposed to a very stern, staunch Presbyterianism, and I figured that somehow, someday, I'd find the key and I would qualify for the love of God and the blessings that others told me that they had bestowed upon Him, if I could ever find that key. But there was something I had to get rid of first, because God is a God of love, and He doesn't allow you to be alone. He doesn't allow you to be hungry. He doesn't allow you not to have anyone to care. So you've done something, or that wouldn't be so. So what's wrong with you? And I didn't know what the answer was. And I can remember, as I say, I didn't fit in. I was so large compared to the rest of them. And I was either too loud or too quiet. I was never in between. When everybody else was speaking softly, I was screaming. And when everybody else was screaming, I was being soft. You know, I was always out of step. And I remember one time I was going to a day camp, and I wanted so desperately to fit in. And I remember getting down on my knees and praying to God, God, let me fit in. Let me not be the oddball. Let me be a part of, or words to that effect. And I went to sleep at my prayers. And when I awakened, I thought, no wonder God doesn't do for you. You can't even stay awake to finish your prayers. You know, always I had both my feet on my own neck and didn't know it. Well, when I was 17, I approached the orphans court and asked permission to leave Pennsylvania, and I gained it. Again, because I was socially mature and I looked older than I was, and I knew, on God, I'd had Emily Post rammed down my throat before pablum, you know. So I knew the right thing to do at the right time and resented it. You know, I'd made almost an art at violating every one of Emily Post's rules, because, again, that part was part of that world that I disliked so. But I approached the court, and they gave me permission. And I chose to go to Southern California. World War II was coming on the scene, and that was as far as I could go. And I did go to Southern California. In the next 3 years, I was to do a considerable amount of drinking, that when I came into the program, I wasn't sure but what I belonged across the hall in AA. And that was resolved for me, as most everything has been, when I've been able to let it just happen. I went to a meeting one night where you'd put your name on a slip of paper and put a quarter in the pot, and when they get the price of a big book, they'd draw a name, and I won a big book, and I took it home and I read it. And of course, my answer was in there, to my satisfaction. And I can't say that I thought, oh good, I do belong in Al-Anon, that's great. Because at that time, my exposure, my experience in Al-Anon was everybody was so good. Mercy sakes, they were good. Alcohol had never crossed their lips, and few of them spoke, and to say, damn or hell, no. And some of the things I said, I still think that sometimes anything you can call an SOB is an SOB. I don't care what anybody says. But anyhow, they are one, aren't they? That's not nice. But I'm not trying to be nice. I'm trying to get well. And that's not funny. That's the truth. Anyhow, I went to California, and I was doing a lot of drinking and a lot of partying. And the opportunity came for me to come to North Carolina with someone that I knew, that I'd roomed with in the Evangeline Residence for Women, run by the Sally. Not charity, just a residence for women. And they had them in many large cities in those days. May still have, I don't know. And I came to North Carolina, and very shortly thereafter, I met my husband-to-be. And still is. I still think that if no one's ever put a miracle in one sentence for you, I shall. Quote, Buck and Virginia are alive and well after 38 years of marriage, period, end quote. That's a miracle. And, you know, it really is. But anyhow, Buck and I started dating, and he says I asked him to marry me, and I say he asks me. It doesn't make any difference. We both thought it was a mistake for most of the time. But anyhow, I had needs I didn't know I had, you know. And I remember thinking to myself, all right, I'm going to tell him I'm going to go back to California. And I'd written a script, and he was going to say, oh, no, don't go. I love you. I need you. I want you to stay. And I was going to say, all right. And so I said to him, I'm going back to California. And he said, when are you leaving? And now, to show you where I was coming from, my false pride was such at the time, I couldn't say, oh, I was kidding, I just wanted to see what you'd say. Saturday morning, I went downtown and bought a ticket, and I went back to California. And I sometimes forget to tell that Buck came to California and got me, but he did. And we returned to North Carolina, and 38 years ago, somebody like me was a real foreigner, you know. I didn't know anything about chopping cotton or baking biscuits and all this kind of good stuff. And I can understand his parents and his family's concern. But to make a long story short, instead of waiting to be married, we were married shortly after our return to North Carolina. And to show you how, isn't it strange, some of the things that happen, and isn't it spooky, some of the things we say. The Saturday night before we were going to be married on Sunday morning, I said to Buck, don't drink tomorrow. And drinking wasn't a problem. But I said, don't drink tomorrow. Well, we got married, and now I have the reverse snobbery. I don't know it. I'm not interested in the fine house and the fine car and the clothes and all that. That's a bunch of stuff. And we were going to live happily ever after. Well, it wasn't exactly like that. But it never crossed my mind. It was anything but my fault. Everything gone wrong. The biggest ego trip anyone can be on is take responsibility for everything that's wrong. That is an ego trip that is sick, sick, sick. And I was on it. Naturally, the marriage wasn't working out like I thought it would, you know. But, of course, what was a third thing in our marriage always, well, before we married and after we married, was drinking. We drank together before we married. We continued to drink afterwards. We would go out. When we go out, Buck would invariably get too much to drink. And then I started thinking things along these lines. What's different? I'm drinking out of the same bottle as he is, and I'm not getting into the trouble he is. Well, I must be smarter. Stronger character, higher morals. There's got to be some reason if you're drinking out of the same jug and you're not getting in the same troubles, you know. Well, we've been married some 4 years, and two daughters have been born to us, and we had an opportunity to go into business for ourselves in South Carolina. And we went down there, and we were very successful. And two things happened, one for Buck and one for me, with that successful business. My self-esteem and my self-confidence were such that running a two-bit business made me feel important and needed. And I was perfectly willing to run that business and let Buck do what was becoming the number one thing in his life, drink and be a club man. Wow, club man. VFW, American Legion, hunting clubs, fishing clubs. They bought their fish and brought them home from the market. I found it out later. You just don't catch rainbow trout in the Atlantic Ocean. I didn't know. Oh, God. And so he was a club man, and he was drinking, and he was gambling, and he was enjoying all the fringe benefits that active alcoholism offers. Oh, yes. And keep it clean, Virginia. Let's see. All right. I got a great sense of fulfillment and satisfaction in running this business for a while. But any time I get my sense of self-worth, self-esteem, and fulfillment based on the wrong things, it won't last. It's terminal. It'll satisfy for a while, but it'll die out. And running this business died out. I can remember saying one time to myself, by this time we had gone through, though, when I would wait up and he would come home, and we're going to talk about this. We'd been through the him walking in one door and my storming out another. We'd been through the silent treatment. You know, the silent treatment that is so much work. It is so hard to pull a silent treatment. Because you have to remember to slam the doors. And you go into the room where they are on purpose so you can be silent. You don't even have any reason to go in that room, but you've got to go in there so they'll know you're not talking to them. And you've got to rattle the pots and pans without cooking, because you're not going to be caught cooking for them. God, they haven't earned the right to be cooked for. And all of these things. You make up the bed to show how good you are, and then you tear it up so they won't have it nice to get into. It's hard work punishing a drunk. It's hard work. Well, I had decided Buck had been gone, and we'd been through all these things, and I had managed the children quite well and the business quite well and run the home without any help from him or anything. So when he returned, I was going to ignore him and just forget he had returned. Later, a doctor told me I was pregnant. Now, that's failure. Now, if you don't... if you understand, you know what I mean. If you don't, that's your problem. I'm not going to explain it. But it is failure, you know. It really is failure. I used to set out, I'd think, I'm going to find him. And I'd get out in the car with a hammer and a screwdriver and a wrench, and I'd ride around. Now, ride around might take me 185 miles to Myrtle Beach to see if he was there. Ride around. When I find him, I'm going to lift the hood, and I'm going to jimmy anything I can with a screwdriver and wrench and the hammer. I'm going to knock out the windows. You know, I'm going to. And it was terrible when I didn't find his car. But it was even worse when I did and couldn't go through with it. The failure to act, to do something dirty. You know, when you fail to do something that's filled with high idealism, et cetera, mountaintop experiences, and you don't reach them, you can figure, well, you know, I was over-anticipating. But when you fail to do something low down and cruddy, that's failure, folks. I'm here to tell you. Well, anyhow, this business got drunk up, and we're in and we're out, and we're up and we're down. And I don't care what your relationship to the alcoholic or to an alcoholic is. It's immaterial. I don't care what your age is. It's immaterial. I don't care what your religion is. It's immaterial. I don't care what your sex is. It's immaterial. I don't care what your education is. It's immaterial. Alcoholism, the family disease, has no respecter of any of those things, nor does recovery. And if you're hung up on, well, you don't understand, it's not my husband, it's my mother, you're hung up in the illness. You'd better get over that if you're going to get to recovery. If you're hung up on, well, you don't understand, it's my daughter and she's only 14. You're hung up in the illness. Get on to recovery. Get beyond it. And if you don't, did you hear what Eleanor said this is? Al-Anon, a meeting of Al-Anon family groups. Al-Anon family. There's no specialized group necessary to find recovery. If you're a part of the family of man, you belong in Al-Anon. If it's your parents instead of your children or instead of your spouse, you don't need something special. You know, it's kind of like a mirror is no more responsible for your looks than the circumstances of your life are responsible for your character. So let's get into recovery. I love recovery, don't you? Love recovery. Get into recovery now. That's the fun part. We moved on Christmas Eve of 1958 back to Charlotte. Now, we did not plan the move. I planned the move. Buck was off drinking. And he had been gone since October. And I couldn't get a job in this town because of his reputation. That was part of it. Part of it was I wasn't very employable. And part of it in those days, I was vacillating between dressing nicely, clean, having my hair done, and et cetera, to going around like a hag, depending on my mood. It depended on whether I felt I had a right to be alive. And if I felt like I had a right to be alive, I'd make an appointment and have my hair done. And I would search and find something decent to wear. But if I felt that I was a scourge of the world, I didn't do any of these things. And you just don't hire people to work in an office that have those extremes in appearance and behavior. And also, if someone would call and say Buck was down at Papa Nash's at Myrtle Beach, I had to go down and see if he was, didn't I? A good wife knows where her husband is. No. Behind every good man, there's a good woman. My husband was a drunk. I had a hell of a lot of work to do. You know, I was really right on. Well, anyhow, I borrowed $100 to move that Christmas Eve. I had returned to Charlotte, and I'd found employment and found a small place for us. And for the girls and I. We have three daughters. And that Christmas Eve afternoon, while we were loading up, my husband returned. And to show you how sick I was afraid of what he would say, because I had made this decision, although I had not heard from him or seen him since the 1st of October. And I can remember my heart was beating as fast as if you're beating your ears. Have your heart ever beaten that fast? You know, you pick up the phone and you can't hear because your heart's beating so fast. And I remember saying to him, I'm leaving here because I couldn't get work. And if you don't want to go with us, you can go. And he said, all right. And I thought, he still loves us. And it wasn't until he got sober in AA that I found out the truth. Immaterial love or not, he was broken. I'd already loaded the bed. But the feeling that he still loved us sustained me many, many hours after that time. During the next 7 years, a lot of things happened. Doesn't really matter what they are. The result of those incidences led to me having the same feelings that you've had. Loneliness, despair, hopelessness. What do you think of when you hear these words? Loneliness. I think of lying in a hospital bed and playing games. The third set of footsteps will be him. Or standing in a hospital window and watching the driveway of the hospital and saying, the fourth car coming from the left will be him. If I don't look at the door, there's steps coming down the hallway, it'll come to this room. If I look at the door, it won't. Playing the games. If I wear that red dress, we'll get along. If I don't, we'll have a fight. If I dare to buy steak for Saturday night, he won't come home. But if I just have beans, he'll come home. Now, he'll fuss about the beans, but he'll come home. So I won't have steak. You get into playing the games with yourself, and that's sick, Bill. I mean, it's sick, Bill. Anyhow, we moved to Charlotte. Buck went with us. And I thought, as I thought many times, it can't get any worse. It can always get worse. Always. And if you're sitting on a nice bank account and living in a nice house and have a nice business, and somebody in your life is sitting on the sipping on the jug, it can get worse. Because that Christmas Eve, when I borrowed $100 to move, 3 years before, we'd paid taxes on $85,000 annual income. So you can drink it up, I know. It can get worse, but Al-Anon's also taught me, it can get better. There's not one side to any coin. There's always another side. There's always another side. The defects of character, there's always the other side. There's always more than what we zero in on in the beginning. Excuse me. Well, during these next, from 1958 until 1967, Buck went to jail and I bailed him out. I went to the hospital and had shock treatments because I couldn't stop crying. We lived in the same house and I spent every cent I had on the girls and on buying good clothes for him so that when he got locked up, they'd know he was from a good family. And then one Monday, and on my first inventory I had down that I was thrifty. I knew I was thrifty because I save ribbon and string and tinfoil and bread wrappers and boxes. I love it when somebody sends me a card and forget to sign it because then I can use it. I iron ribbon off of packages and I cut off where paper has been folded. Wrap a smaller gift the next time out. Save clothes I can no longer wear in case I lose weight. That was another thing. The doctor used to be on me about my weight, and I'd say, oh, well, I get so worried, you know, and I catch myself in the kitchen eating, and he'd say, I know. Since Buck got sober, I've gained 36 pounds. Anyhow, I went in the kitchen this Monday to fix lunch. And I reached in the refrigerator, I took a mayonnaise jar that had leftover salad, and I tucked it under my arm, and I reached for something else, and the lid came off, and the salad went all over the kitchen floor. And in what was normal for me, normal for Buck was drunk, normal for me was angry. The top of my lungs, God, what else do you expect of me? That damn drunk and now this mess. He's not drunk. He's in the living room waiting for you to fix lunch. How long has it been since he's come home drunk? Who is it who's been phoning him? I knew they were sober. I can smell a drunk on the phone any day. Sober, well-dressed people have been coming by the office to see him. Where is it he said he's been going? He's been going out every night. He's been saying, I'll see you about 9:30 or 10. He's been coming home at 9:30 or 10. God, that's the most traumatic thing that can happen to the family of an alcoholic. Is when an alcoholic says they'll do something, they just do it when they say they'll do it. It absolutely destroys you. There's nothing you can count on anymore. Nothing you can count on anymore. And then I started getting angry. Boy, God, he's still going out every night and I'm still running this two-bit business. Drunk or sober, I'm still sitting him here while he's doing what he wants. I'll bet he hasn't told him what a good wife he has. I bet they don't know how I've stood by him. How I've raised this family, kept this business. Wasn't for me, he wouldn't have this business. They don't know that. I'm going. I don't know where it is he's going, but I'm going too. Now, how do I get that across to him? Because we don't go places together in these days. Okay, I'm your wife. I have a right to go. I want to meet these people. I'm not sitting here alone anymore. So about 7:30, my husband comes in. He said, well, I'll see you about 9:30 or 10. And I said, well, I'm going too. He said, all right, come on. I could have killed him. I didn't get to use any of my reasons. Well, we went out and we got in the car. Now, I told you about drinking with him and not getting into the trouble that he did, so there was something different, superior, about me. And when you're superior, you're a know-it-all. And a know-it-all can't ask questions. So when I got in the car with him, I couldn't say, where are we going? Because then he would know I didn't know, and I didn't want him to know I didn't know. So we drove across town, and the further we go, the more like a blowfish out of the water I'm getting. And we walked in, and he pointed to a stairwell, and he said, they meet down there. I didn't know who they were, but I died for it, asked him. And I went downstairs to my first Al-Anon meeting. Now, God, as I understand him, was working in my life. First of all, that I chose to go that night. And it was closed AA and Al-Anon. And I'm so grateful I didn't get to an open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous first. We have too many, in my estimation, they're non-alcoholic members of Open AA. They're not Al-Anon, and they're not AA, and they cause a lot of trouble. And you're no more Al-Anon because of a marriage license or a birth certificate than you are a member of AA if you're out there drinking. And when you're talking to people and they say they're not an alcoholic, don't assume they're an Al-Anon, because they aren't, unless they go to meetings, are trying very much with the help of the God of their understanding to base their lives on the principles that these steps tell us, teach us about. I also know that God was working in my life because I've been privileged to attend meetings in virtually every state in the United States except Canada and Hawaii. I mean, Alaska and Hawaii. Buck says we're going to Hawaii as soon as they build the bridge. And in Canada, Ann that shared that night, I've never seen again. It was sufficient that she was in one room one night willing to share. I did not get the newcomer welcome, but I got something better. I was exposed to and a part of a meeting that stuck to the purpose, which is to welcome and comfort the relatives and friends of alcoholics, learn to understand and encourage the alcoholic to grow spiritual ourselves through the 12 steps. And that attracted me. I thought Ann was crazy, but I knew I was, so that made two of us. And as long as you're not the only one, then it's tolerable, you know. And I started going to meetings. And I was more comfortable than I had been, but I still wasn't comfortable. They were so good. And everybody was saying to the effect, since John's been in AA and I've been in Al-Anon, life has just been wonderful. We haven't had a cross word. I'm like, God! I had a whole new carload of guilt because Buck and I were wah, 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 to the meeting. Get out. Hello? Get at the meeting. Get back. What do they know I don't know? What are they doing? What am I missing? I'm one of those people that got an order blank right after I came in and put 11111 beside everything, ordered one copy of everything. Read it all. And I didn't, you know, what is it I'm missing? And I get close to these people that were 12 feet off the ground and were able to walk across the water, all that. And I found out they argued just like Buck and I. And I said, why aren't you talking about the fact that everything isn't ginger peachy at meetings? Oh, we don't want to discourage people. I said, you've discouraged the hell out of me because I thought something was possible in you that I've not been able to attain. Give me the truth. It's the greatest gift we can ever give anyone, the truth. And when our own ego gets in the way and we want somebody to like us, so we lie and tell them what they want to hear, we're not at all loving. Not at all. Well, anyhow, I was going to meetings and it was better, but I still wasn't real comfortable. And then I heard another lady talk, and she spoke of going to meetings simply for the meeting to be over and have an opportunity to dump her garbage. And she said this one lady would listen to her all the time, and invariably the lady would say to her when she'd run down, blown her top, well, have you tried the steps? And she said she got so tired of hearing that, she decided, I'm going home, I'm going to do those steps. And then when she asks me, I'm going to say yes, and they don't work. And she went home, and she said she started tokenism with the steps, and things changed. And I felt like the cartoon, you know, where the light bulb's going off. I thought, wow, if that happened with that approach to the steps, I want my life to change. I'm going to try those steps. And I went home, and I started, and it's still the way I study the steps. I got everything on the steps, AA and Al-Anon literature alike. When I have something help me through a difficult time, or something help me keep my head where it's supposed to be when things are exceptionally good, I don't know whether I've heard it from an AA or from an Al-Anon. But you see, forgive me, I don't see you as having wisdom of your own. I see you as being God's channels. And I think the wisdom that an AA shares with me, or an Al-Anon shares with me, is God's wisdom. And I think, you know, we're twice blessed when we're a channel. It's kind of like trying to put perfume on somebody. You can't put perfume on someone and not get someone yourself. And you can't be a channel in the program without being blessed in the process. But anyhow, I went home and I got everything on the steps, and I'd read everything on step one. And then I'd close the books and I'd think about it. And I would come to a conclusion about it at that time, and then I would pick up the literature. It might be, I don't know what lengths of time. I really don't. Then I would read the first step, and then I'd read everything on the second step, and I'd close the books, and I'd think about it, and I'd come to a conclusion about that at this time. And I did this over and over and over and over again. In the process, I looked up a lot of words. I found out people use words they don't mean the meanings of. I find out people use words they have impressions of meanings, and they've heard them used elsewhere in another frame, and they think it fits. I found out I didn't know the real meanings of words. I found out I didn't know that love was an unselfish, outgoing concern for another's well-being. I didn't know resentment was my inability to accept the fact I can't change somebody or something. I didn't know there was a difference between pleasure and happiness. I didn't know that it's very pleasant in the summer to have a bathing suit and go in a lake. But in December in Minnesota, it's not very comfortable to put on a bathing suit and go in a lake. But I found out happiness knows no season. And it's an inside job. And it's based not on things or people or circumstance, but based on principles. And those principles can be found embodied in our program. In all three legacies of our program, recovery, unity, and service. I found out that there was a difference between caused and contributed. I had heard for a lot of years, if it wasn't for you, I wouldn't get drunk. And I got so I believed it. And then they said, you didn't cause it, you can't cure it, and you can't control it. Oh, great. And then my sponsor said, but you contributed. How? I prolonged his act of alcoholism through my false pride because I kept standing between him and the consequences of his drinking. I bailed him out, not so he wouldn't be in jail, but I didn't want my husband in jail. There's a lot of things that I did, a lot of thoughts that I had, a lot of things I wanted to do that I didn't. And I don't share anything to shock or to entertain anyone here. And if you are either shocked or entertained, then that is your condition. I share for the simple reason that I need to remember where I'm coming from. And in the event there's someone here that has lived with someone like me, you need know that there are others like that person. Or if there's someone here that has thought and felt as I have felt, and don't know that there's someone else that has felt the same things, you have a right to know that you're not alone. I have a few minutes. I'm going to talk about the steps a little bit, because that's the program. It's always wonderful to get together and go to the beach or go to conventions, sit around and eat coffee and cake and the fellowship. You know, that's grand. But the program is based in the steps. And it's available to us wherever we are. And we really don't need, we want, but we don't need other people in our program. All we need is ourselves and the God of our understanding. The first step says, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives were unmanaged, had become unmanageable. I found it difficult to admit that I was powerless over alcohol because I could take a drink or leave it alone. And I rejected what people said powerless over the alcoholic. Because I'm Orthodox Al-Anon. It said the 12 steps of AA, and the first step of the 12th step of AA doesn't say anything about an alcoholic. And then I started believing that I was powerless because AAs and Al-Anons were telling me I was. And then the time came I admitted that I was powerless over alcohol. I couldn't even refuse the first drink for another person. But that isn't all that I'm powerless over. I'm powerless over time and place and circumstance. I'm so powerless I can't even dig a hole and crawl in. And then I had a sense of failure being powerless. And then I had to realize it wasn't failure, it was truth. And I used the analogy of driving a car. I am not responsible for how you drive yours. If you have a wreck or get a ticket, I'd be foolish if I didn't get out of the way if it got in my lane. But I don't have to feel guilty by how you drive your car. Nor can I blame you for how I drive mine. Now that was the biggest part of admitting I was powerless. Because it's kind of like letting go of a tiger's tail. You free yourself, but you free the tiger of being responsible. And I don't think I wanted to say all the things that happened in my life. I wanted to put them on a chain like beads and hold them up and say, see, this is what my life has been. Because then you might say, oh, no wonder Virginia's like she is. And I got in Al-Anon, I held up my chain, and they said, so what? You know, there's no recovery in saying it's because of these things I am like I am. There's no recovery. You stay in the sickness. My life is unmanageable. I came to realize it had been unmanageable since I was about 5 minutes old. I went through a lot of time of back to a certain episode in our lives, a certain time, you know. But the truth of it is, it has been unmanageable until I found a manager and was willing to have a manager and surrendered to the manager and listened to the manager. But any time I take it back, my life is unmanageable again. The second step says, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. I had no qualms with the need to be restored to sanity. And a lot of new people in the program seem to have difficulty with that. And I always say, just give them time. They'll come to understand. One of the most insane things we do is live in active alcoholism for years and just stand there and wait for it to hit us again and again and again. There is not another illness in which we would do that. There's not one of us that has a spouse or a family member with cancer that we'd just stand there and would do nothing. We'll go out and find out. What can be done? What can I do? Is there something in the home? Is there a diet? You know, but not in alcoholism. Part of the disease is that we stand there and just wait, and that's insane. Coming to believe was what was hard for me. Because, you see, I didn't want to admit that I loved God or needed God because God turned his back on me. Okay? I couldn't say to Buck, I love you and I need you and I miss you. I couldn't say to Buck, I need money for lunch. Because the way he was doing, he didn't love me. But he'd never said it straight out. But if I'd indicate any need and turn to him, he might say it out in words. I just couldn't take risked. But I came to believe first in the people. And I believe in people. My belief came through their eyes. Eyes are the window of the soul. I've stood up in front of groups, and I've shared in discussion meetings, and I've seen a lot of dead eyes. I've seen a lot of closed doors. I've seen a lot of bodies in chairs. But I also have seen a lot of response. I have seen in. And through your eyes, I have learned. And through your eyes touching me, in that touch, I have grown. And I have found acceptance. Not approval, but acceptance. And I came to believe in you. And I had such expectations of you that were unreal, impossible for you to live up to. And that sent me right to step 3. Because by this time, I'm wanting to live. And I'm wanting things to change. And steps 3 is where I can really depend. I love you. I love you. And I would never willingly or knowingly deceive you or let you down. But I'm human, and I cannot meet your needs. And this is what happened to me. But God can and will. He'll never desert you. And so I came to believe, came into the third step after I had come to believe, and I made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood him. And I say understood him because I'm talking about the steps I have taken. I'll bring you to today in just a few minutes. I really think I came to the point that I made the decision when I was praying a prayer one day that many of you will be familiar with, in which I was asking God to relieve me of my difficulties, that it would be evidence of his power to others. And the thought came to me faster than I can share it. God, if you want me to remain unchanged, that's all right. It doesn't matter. Whatever you want is okay with me. Because I knew that whatever God wanted me to be, he would give me what I would need to come through it. The physical strength, the courage, whatever. Whatever. And no sooner than I really had that feeling through my entire being, I knew it wasn't necessary. And I made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood him. And these 3 steps tell me where I'm starting from and what I'm starting with and my action. When we decided to come to Monteagle, the decision in itself didn't get us here. We had to get in the car and make the trip. And the decision in 3 doesn't get you there. You got to make the trip. And for me, it starts with 4. Made a searching and fearless moral inventory of myself. Not an exercise in self-condemnation. Not a comparison of me with thee. When I'm feeling great, I compare the best of me against the worst of you, and I'm always superior. And when I have stuffed a lot of anger and jealousy down and am depressed, I compare the worst of me against the best of you, and I'm even worse. So I try to compare me with me. I believe in a written inventory. I go to market, I take a list, and it doesn't matter if I don't get something at the store. But my inventory is my life. It's more than my life. It's eternity. and I believe in a written one. I took this written inventory, and I went to someone after reviewing it and admitted to God, to myself, and then to another human being, the exact nature of my wrongs. I remember saying to my sponsor, why does it say admit to God? You've told me God loves me better than I love myself, and you told me that he loves me better. She said, think about it. Sponsor's supposed to answer questions. But she didn't, so I thought about it. And I realized it's not for God's benefit. Not a single thing in these steps is for anyone's benefit but mine. And it's an exercise in self-discipline and honesty and patience and tolerance and everything to take an inventory and to admit to God and to the other human being. And I had a sense of salvation after my last fifth step. And there will be some of you, the hair came up on your neck when I said salvation. But if you will read our literature, you will find the word in. It is not unknown to AA and Al-Anon literature. Salvation comes from the Hebrew, and it means to come home. And I had a sense of coming home. I had a sense of love and acceptance that I always wanted from my mother that I didn't have. I wanted Buck to be everything to me. How unfair of me to expect that of him. I wanted him to be my lover, my husband, my companion, my confessor, my pal. I wanted him to be everything. And he couldn't be. It wasn't his fault. I had such terrible needs, but I found so many answers and so many sources help in fulfillment of these needs through the program. I don't have time to go into depth. I'm going to have to move on. Sixth step says we're entirely ready to have God remove these defects of character. I've had more difficulty with this step than any other. In the fourth step, I found out my need that I never wanted to admit to because I thought it was perverse and selfish and egocentric and all, to be loved and to be accepted and to feel secure. I found out those are human needs. I found out that I, a human being with God's love, have a right to pursue them, but it needs to be in a healthy way so that it doesn't warp my life or the lives of those around me. And I found out that I joined the human race with that. And with step six, I found out that it was in God's time. I also found out that God doesn't remove anything, although he could, in which there's a learning experience for me. I was dealing with the self-pity. Oh, I just hated the self-pity. And then through a series of things I won't go into, someone said, you are feeling sorry for yourself. Well, I knew up here what the antidote with self-pity was. So I started reading everything I could on gratitude, started making gratitude lists. Thank God for dirty ashtrays. I like to smoke. I have the money to buy them. Thank God for dirty dishes. We have food to eat. Thank God for dirty clothes. We have more than one outfit. Now, that may not seem like much to some of you, but I've had the time in my life I took the clothes off my back and washed them before I could go out again. I've had the time in my life I did not eat. I had sores in my mouth for no food. So there are things to be grateful for. God could have removed the self-pity, but he didn't, because there was a lesson there for me to seek and learn more of gratitude. My God can do anything. He's tremendous. He has a tremendous sense of humor. Tremendous sense of humor. I remember one time being asked to share at a meeting, and I assumed it was an Al-Anon meeting, and it wasn't. It was a church meeting, and they were introducing various community resources to the congregation, and I'm to share on Al-Anon, and it's the whole deal with the minister in robes and the choir and the whole thing, and I'm walking up that aisle behind him, and I'm not walking on water, and you know, I'm saying, God, don't let me cuss, you'd understand, but they never would, you know? And that's the God of my understanding. It really is. I found out there's not a thing about me that offends my God or runs him off. He hurts for me, I think. And I visualize him saying, oh, Virginia, when are you going to learn? But he's not offended by me. He wants better for me. He wants the best for me. Anyhow, step seven says, we humbly asked him to remove these shortcomings. To me, shortcomings and defects of character You can debate them all you want. If you hurt over something, whether what makes the difference whether it's a defect of character or a shortcoming? The cause of pain can be different, but pain is pain. Shortcomings and defects of character, to me, are the same. The humbly. People say if you mention humility, you have none. And I just love for people to say that, and I wait. And then they'll say, oh, I'm so grateful. I say, don't say that. Why not? You just said a moment ago, if you mention humility, you have none. Then don't mention gratitude, you don't have any. What do you mean? You cannot isolate humility from all the other emotions and say you can't talk about that, but you can talk about the others. Now, what is your conception of humility? To me, humility is honesty. I don't know about you, but I know that I have neither earned nor deserved the right to have what I have in my life today. And I'm not speaking of the abundance of material things. I'm speaking of love and forgiveness, a sense of belonging, and a power on whom I can rely, and always, no matter where I am. And that humbles me. I have yet to meet anyone that has earned the right to this program. We can talk about paying our dues all we want, but the world is full of people that are paying higher dues than you and I ever paid. They're not here. And I think about a poem about a king who was bored at a banquet. And he said to the jester, "Jester, pray for us a prayer." And the jester took off his clown's cap and he prayed the most eloquent of prayers. And the king hung his head and he left the banquet hall and he went out in the garden and he said, "Lord, be merciful to me, a fool." And when we brag about how far we've come and how many dues we've paid, I think to myself, "Lord, be merciful to me, a fool." The eighth step says we made a list of persons we had harmed, became willing to make amends to them all. My list started in 4, and my list is not prior Al-Anon. The most difficult amends to make are the ones for my failures since I've been in the program. The ninth step says made direct amends to such people whenever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. I think it means quite simply, I don't have a right to ease my guilty conscience at your expense. I had a beautiful sister. She was beautiful. Had wheat-colored hair and big blue eyes. Could eat everything in that room up there and never gain a pound. Every guy that came down the block loved her, including my boyfriends, which were few. And I hated that. And I was jealous of her. She was a cheerleader, you know. And I never said, "Jean, you look pretty." I never said when she was the leading role in the play at school, "You did a good job." I pouted and didn't communicate and just was a pure pain. And it wasn't her fault. It was my insecurity and my envy and my jealousy. And I needed to go to my sister and tell her this. And I postponed until I got my head together more. And when I went and knocked on her door, she had died. And I did not get an opportunity to make direct amends. So if you get the nudge to make amends, listen. And I've asked the God of my understanding, who I believe is in touch with those I can see on this earth, as well as those that have gone on, that if there are any dregs of any of that, with that that is Jean, that he relieve her of it. The tenth step is the maintenance step. Continue to take personal inventory, and when we're wrong, promptly admit it. Continue to take personal inventory. And I think they knew I was coming when they put in promptly. I don't like to do anything promptly. I want to be sure. But to keep on doing it, I try to do it every day. I was in the program a long time before I realized if my day was going bananas, I could stop and take a 10th step, even if it was 10 o'clock in the morning, and start another day. And that's a wonderful freedom. And I've gone into more than one restroom and closed the little door and said, God, let's start a new day, please. And it's wonderful. The 11th step I call the happiness step, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understand Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. Didn't say found, sought. That means if I bring into the present tense, I seek. Through prayer and meditation, knowledge of God's will for me and the power to carry it out. I think it's the open prayer. And you know, when I was thinking about buying a car not long ago. I didn't ask God for a car. I asked God to let me know if it was the thing to do. And I asked God if it wasn't the thing to do to put obstacles in my path and allow me to accept those obstacles as direction, because I'm thick. I'm thick. I don't take hints. God, let me know. And I don't find it out of... it's part of my program to talk over God, anything that's going on in my life. Anything. But I don't ask Him for anything. I accept guidance. I ask Him for acceptance where disappointment and heartbreak are concerned. I ask Him to love people that I have found it difficult to love. But I don't ask Him for things. I know He'll give me whatever I need. Maybe not what I want, but what I need. And the 12th step says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to others and to practice these principles in all our affairs. I have had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. If my obituary had been written 18 years ago and I were to die today, you could use it. Nothing's changed. But I've changed. I can truly say, oh God, that's great when somebody gets something nice, gets a promotion, has a success in their life, with no jealousy. I can really do it. That's amazing. It's amazing. I can live and let live most of the time. I ain't perfect. And for me, there's built-in forgiveness in this step because it says practice. Practice means through learning, through frequent use, through repetition. And I say to anyone that says, I'm bored with meetings, they're not bored with meetings, they're bored with life. Because this is how we learn to live, isn't it, one day at a time? I'm afraid I've talked too long. I thank you for allowing me to be here, and I'd like to close with the lines that someone else wrote that tells you where I am today and have been for a long time. Beck and I have a good relationship. We still disagree. We're both very aggressive. He in a very quiet way, and me in a very way. You know. Beck, you know, sometimes I'll say, he's so bullheaded and stubborn, immovable. Oh! But it's usually when he's doing something I'm not in favor of. He uses those same characteristics, something I want, and I say, he's persevering and tenacious and, you know, hangs in there. Attributes. It's all in perspective how I see him. We have a beautiful relationship with our children. We take a week's family vacation together every year and have for about 5 years. Virtually every Wednesday night they're at our house for dinner. And it's great. We care for one another. We care about one another. We share with one another. They all are well versed in the program. And it's wonderful. It hurts sometimes, and they'll say, what step you working on, Mother? You know, I don't like that. But the lines that someone else wrote. I know not what the future holds of marvel or surprise. I'm assured alone that life and death God's mercy underlies. And if my heart and flesh are weak to bear an untried pain, the bruised reed God will not break, but strengthen and sustain.
No offering of my own I have, no works my faith to prove. I can but give the gift he gave and plead his love for love. I know not where God's islands lift their fronded palms in air. I only know I cannot drift beyond his love and care. And if my faith is vain, and if my hopes betray, pray for me that I may find a surer, safer way. And thou, O Lord, who knows thy creatures as they be, forgive me if too close I lean my human heart to thee. Thank you.